In 2012, freelance journalist Theo Padnos was in a Turkish border town looking for a way into Syria to cover the civil war. The men who volunteered to guide him through the country were not who they said they were. Once over the border into Syria, they kidnapped him, tortured him, moved him from prison to prison for 2 years, and threatened Padnos with execution. His memoir of that time, Blindfold, is now out in paperback. I spoke with Padnos when the book was first published in February of 2021. And I hope you don't mind me saying this, but after reading your book, it does seem like you went into this war zone unprepared. You had no support from a news organization, no assignments. At what point did you realize that these men who were supposed to be helping you were actually members of an Al-Qaeda affiliate and meant you great harm?
I personally did not realize until they put the gun to my head. I make a point of this in the book. I underline my blindness and when I could see how little, in fact, I was seeing. And once they put the blindfold on me, then I began to understand. So this is the paradox of seeing in an Islamic State, is that every citizen there, all the young recruits in the jihad, every average, everyday citizen who submits to that kind of government, and of course the prisoners, you deprive yourself of your senses, your sense of orientation in the world, your own identity. You lose all of that. And for me, it was a physical blindness and a period of extended terror. You're meant to awaken with a deeper and truer, more profound, more moral orientation in life. And I think that happened to me. Of course, I, who at first thought the rebels were possibly a force for good, I woke up with a deeper and truer orientation, knowing that they are evil and wicked. But most people who go through these experiences of a prison in an Islamic State, even the prisoners, the poor prisoners they abuse so horribly, wake up loving these guys.
Something like a Stockholm syndrome.
I don't know if it's Stockholm syndrome. You call it brainwashing. Perhaps it is Stockholm syndrome, although at a certain point, 8 million citizens of Iraq and Syria were under the control of these people. Not all of them were victims of Stockholm syndrome.
But you, Theo, you were tortured. You were beaten terribly so. Did you think that eventually you were going to be executed? I mean, what did you think they had in store for you?
Of course. I made a calendar on my wall, maybe in the first week or something. It was October of 2012. And I'm like, why should I even bother with November? I'm going to be dead by then. So I didn't do a November. But then November came along. I'm like, all right, I'll do till Thanksgiving. And, you know, the point of an Islamic prison in an Islamic State today is to make you leave the world of this life. So they what they do is they subject you to a near-death experience in prison.
Theo, your kidnappers were seeking an Islamic State, but they were not the Islamic State. I wonder if you can help explain the political situation in Syria at the time of your captivity. You were captured by an Al-Qaeda affiliate that were actually at war with the Islamic State. What was going on?
When I first arrived in Syria in October of 2012, there was one large resistance movement against the government of President Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria. So there were many factions in this movement. There were some that were like more Islamist flavored and some that said that we want a secular government over this country and people can choose their own religions. Relatively early on, the fundamentalists, the people with the most moral authority on the ground in that country, they took power over everybody else. And within the rebellion, there was a split, which occurred while I was in prison, in which one half of the fundamentalists called themselves the Islamic State. The other half said, we're going to be Jabhat al-Nusra. It means the victory front. You know, one group of fundamentalists went one way. They called themselves ISIS. Mm. Another group went another way. They said, we're going to call ourselves Al-Qaeda. It was really a branding exercise. They believed in exactly the same things. There was no difference in aims or anything. They both dreamed of a beautiful Islamic golden time for Syria and then for the whole world. I was a prisoner of one half of this fundamentalist movement. And at one point, the top guys in my group said, let's go make war on the other group. And they fought each other for a little while, and they're pretty much friends again.
How did you consider God while you were in captivity? Because you were often surrounded by men of deep faith that was driving them to do what they did to you.
In the beginning, I was terrified by Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. And I felt that it was a summons to the evil within these people around me. And I just, Friday afternoons when they have their big prayer, it terrified me. I just felt that Islam was making life more dangerous for me because it was telling everybody to die. So you ask how I felt about God. I certainly didn't become religious, but I want peace for everybody. I want and I have no resentment against Muslims, but I do think that religion can be ill-used against its own practitioners, the people for whom it normally brings comfort and solace, and it can quickly be corrupted and make them do crazy things.
Well, you did not find God, I guess, in prison, but it seems like one of your fellow prisoners at least tried to, or at least made a front of trying to. Matt Schreier, the American photojournalist, converted to Islam, hoping that it would help him get released. But you never did that. Why?
I was afraid that they were going to accuse me of bad faith if I said, yes, yes, I believe, and then they would find out that I wasn't praying regularly, or they would notice that I wasn't that into the prayer. So I was afraid that they were going to discover that I was lying about the religion and, of course, kill me for that. But also, I did not want to convert until they had the gun on my head or the knife at my throat, and then I could say, fine, la ilaha illallah, there is no God but God, wa Muhammadan Rasulullah. If you say that, then technically you're a Muslim, and I could say, fine, I'm with you guys now, don't kill me. But it was like my last get-out-of-jail-free card or get-out-of-execution-free card, and I wasn't going to play it until they made me play it, and they never actually made me play it.
Yeah, Theo, you were in a class of people who were not anywhere near as lucky as you. Five people who were kidnapped in Syria around the same time, James Foley, Kayla Mueller, Peter Kasig, Austin Tice, and you. The first three were killed. We still don't know what happened to Austin Tice, and I wonder if you just sometimes reflect on how in the world you were the one to make it out alive.
I know why I made it out alive. What happened was, when the ISIS men decided to form their own little group, they took their own prisoners from our prison, and those were James Foley and a few of the European hostages. Jabhat al-Nusra, al-Qaeda people, took their prisoners and went the other direction. They had a little divorce, and the reason why I survived is because Jabhat al-Nusra eventually lost a war that they were having with ISIS, and they needed cash, so they bartered me for cash. Wow. ISIS at the time was flush with cash. They didn't need the money. They wanted a big media hit. They were making these very captivating films, and they were discovering what a drug social media can be. So the reason why I survived was because, out of sheer luck, the commanders decided to give certain prisoners to al-Qaeda, and other prisoners went to ISIS.
And you were there watching as James Foley was murdered on one of those videos, and you were in the captivity of these men, or at least their sympathizers. That must have been horrendous for you.
I looked at the crawl, and the crawl said, American journalists executed in Syria. I read that, and I'm like, wait, I'm the American journalist prisoner in Syria, and I'm not being, what's going on? And I was not aware, of course, at the time that there were other American journalist prisoners in Syria, but the first time I became aware of it, was when I saw James Foley on TV, and there was these bunch of very crazy, psychotic murderers and killers who had already killed tons of people for useless, stupid, idiotic reasons in the room behind me. I knew these people well, and I changed the channel. I'm like, I don't want to give these lunatics bad ideas. But happily, by that time, the chief al-Qaeda guy was already in touch with Qatar, who eventually ransomed me out of Syria.
The ending of your book is very powerful. You describe your release and what it felt like. You wanted to live so badly, but this terrible thing that happened to you is now 6 years or more in the past. How are you doing? Do you feel whole? Do you feel okay?
Yes, I feel very... I'm delighted to be alive. I'm delighted that I have a beautiful place to live. I have a lovely partner. I have a beautiful dog and kitty cat, and can ski and play tennis and hockey and live a life. I'm happy to be alive. But I, to the extent that I am frustrated and bitter, which I am on behalf of the people of Syria and all my fellow prisoners who I feel have been so mistreated by the world, and I really would like to be able to give something back to those people who helped me so much in my hour of need. My fellow prisoners and their families. And a lot of these people have disappeared, and it would be nice if we could find some information about what happened to them.
Theo Padnos, the book is called Blindfold, a memoir of capture, torture, and enlightenment. Theo, thank you so much.
Thank you for talking to me.
Our interview from February 2021. You heard us talking about James Foley. Well, later this week, we'll be speaking with Foley's mother, Diane. The man accused of kidnapping and murdering him is now on trial.